Mr. Powers, good morning to you.
Good morning.
I should note for everybody, we're going to take a little break immediately after this case.
Mr. Chief Justice, Justices, my name is Vince Powers. Here's my badge. That took, I guess we did in slow motion, 1/10 of a second. Had Deputy Rourke done that, my client would not have been beat up, would not have been arrested. We wouldn't have had 3-4 years of litigation. That isn't good enough. Good morning. Here's my warrant. That took 1/10 of a second. Or, as I walk into the house. Good morning, my name is Vince Powers. This is an extraordinarily simple case that somehow has gotten here for a second time, and it makes no sense. Let's just talk about the actual facts.
Well, what the trial court on the remand made a finding that there was qualified immunity and therefore, as a matter of law, dismissed the case.
Right.
What factual issues remained in the case when it was remanded to the trial court for further proceedings?
From Waldron 1?
Yes.
None.
Well, there was an issue of fact as to whether or not the entry into the house was unreasonable, and there was a question of fact as to whether or not the officer used excessive force.
Okay. Yes, I misunderstand your question. But
so how does the trial court make a determination of fact as to those two questions that we determined remained as material issues of fact?
Well, I don't.
The trial court has, in order to find qualified immunity, the trial court has to make a factual finding that the entry was reasonable and that the force used was not unreasonable.
I agree.
So how can you do that on the same facts that were brought to us on Walden 1?
I can't speak to that.
So what do you see the remand as consisting of? Pardon me.
I guess, Your Honor, case was remanded. Defendant wanted this qualified immunity heard on the same record. Record that was not, I think you can say, well, the Supreme Court did not deal with that. Let's look at whether or not those facts give rise to qualified immunity.
Well, when you were here the first time, you told us, didn't you, that qualified immunity had not been raised at that time?
Correct. You asked me, and it had not. No, I think the question was, did the district, is it before us?
The district court didn't decide it.
Or because the district court had not ruled on it. Now the district court went back and ruled on it.
And now it's before us.
Correct. And I'm saying that qualified immunity is, under these facts, what I read the district court to say was exigent circumstances somehow excused doing this. And the facts were, this was a serving a misdemeanor warrant. There's a fugitive task force that was not called in because this is not much of anything. The exigent circumstances cases, whether it's hot pursuit, whatever, all go to not having a warrant. Here there was a warrant. The deputy left the warrant in the car. We still have the same.
You leave the warrant in the car?
I believe that's where the warrant was. He never showed it. We don't dispute there was a warrant.
Does that put exigent circumstances into play then?
No. There aren't any exigent circumstances here. There's nothing in this record to support a home invasion. This is a plainclothes officer who was asked by the widow of a state patrol captain who had been instructed never let a stranger in your house without a warrant or badge to simply say, do you have a warrant? Do you have a badge? He had a lantern around his neck. It's in his deposition. That's why I brought mine. All he had to do was show it. It was a little colder. He had it underneath his sweater jacket. That's all there was. There's no extent. And there's this odd argument that he was suicide by cop. That was a man to me, a police officer who had that knowledge. not Rourke. It's in her deposition. It's cited to in their record as if Rourke had that information, but it comes from her. All he knew, and as Walter once said, there's some vague notion of a weapons charge. We don't know what the weapons charge is. What we know is this opinion, if affirmed, means every person in Nebraska, when a stranger knocks on your door, you have to let them in if they say we're the police. And as Justice Connolly asked last time we were here, does that mean you can go into my bedroom and take my jewelry if I ask? So the right is clearly established, and Deputy Rourke knew that he had to show a badge because he testified, I did show a badge. That's all this case says. Jury says, we believe her. Jury says, we believe him. Jury says, we can't believe either one. Therefore, the defendant wins. That's all this is. The district court talks about no cases talking about this. There aren't any cases like this because it is so clearly established. My goodness, the Luck case, the Hell's Angels in Omaha are now considered more dangerous than my 78-year-old widow, 5'1" and 145. The Eighth Circuit affirmed in Luck saying, even though they're Hell's Angels, even though you know they're drugs there, and even though you know they dislike law enforcement, still have to, that's not extra.
What do you have to prove to establish qualified immunity?
You have to show, I think you would have to show in this case, or you have to show that the right is somehow, you know, vague, right? For example.
Well, there isn't any, is there a dispute as to the person's right to be free from unreasonable searches and seizures in their home? Is that firmly established right?
Yes, it is.
Okay. And is there an issue as to whether or not the right was clearly established at the time of the challenged conduct?
It's been that right for over 200 years in this country.
Is exigent circumstances, is that vague?
That is not in this case, it's not applicable in this case. There aren't any exigent circumstances.
Didn't the officer see Koppel in the house?
Sure.
Okay, and didn't they ask Waldron, is he in the house?
No. One very important fact, Your Honor. A stranger comes and knocks on your door in Lincoln, Nebraska, where Roger Bortland impersonated a police officer and murdered Candy Harms. She said, do you have a warrant? Do you have a badge? Who are you? And he burst in. It took more time for him to invade her home than to simply reach in and say, here's my badge.
So she didn't tell him that Coppola wasn't in the house?
Of course she did. She would protect her grandson. These guys could have murdered him. Who are these people, Your Honor?
Well, what facts carry
over? And that doesn't even matter.
What facts carry over to this hearing on the determination of qualified immunity? Isn't there still a material issue of fact as to whether or not the entry was unreasonable?
Sure.
And isn't there a material issue of fact as to whether or not excessive force was used
Absolutely.
In accomplishing what the police officer did?
Absolutely, because again...
And do those things create a material issue of fact with regard to whether there was qualified immunity?
Absolutely. And in addition, this whole thing with excessive force, she's protecting her grandson from strangers who refuse to identify themselves. And Your Honor, what another important fact is, when the uniformed police officers come, she immediately cooperated. She's a member of the law enforcement family her entire life.
Are there any cases out there where we have a case where the person shows up in an unmarked car at night, comes to the door in a sweatshirt and a ball cap, and demands entry into the home without displaying a badge or any evidence of authority?
And there may very well be criminal cases where impersonators invaded homes under those circumstances, but no law enforcement officers do that.
Well, we're looking at to whether or not the court could make a determination as a matter of law that the officers had qualified immunity. Isn't that the only issue?
That's it, Your Honor.
Mr. Powers, before you sit down, what do you think is your strongest argument? You've got a number of places here.
I'm an American. You can't come into my house without a badge or a warrant.
So it's that initial...
That's initially it. had he gone like this, or had he pulled out the warrant, and he, you know, and to answer your earlier question, leaving the warrant in the car doesn't create an exigent circumstance. Seeing that person, okay, there's the bay window. I see Cobble. I reach in. There it is. That's my... Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Is it Mr.
Durbin?
Mr. Durbin, good morning to you.
May it please the court, Dave Durbin, Deputy County Attorney, Lancaster County Attorney's Office, for Appley Deputy James Jordan. Unlike the first appearance of this case before the court, where the question was whether a reasonable jury could find on the merits for the appellant, today the question is whether a reasonable officer could find Deputy Rourke's actions justified. As the Eighth Circuit has explained, officers under qualified immunity are not liable for bad guesses in gray areas. They are liable only for transgressing bright lines of clearly established law with the Constitution.
What are the gray areas, do you think, under at least so far the undisputed facts?
We have accepted appellant's record as it is. We have several different areas in this case. We have probable cause. We have also excessive force and exigent circumstances related to knock and announce. The real gray area would be the claim under knock and announce with respect to exigent circumstances. With respect to the first two claims that I mentioned, this court has recognized it is the plaintiff's burden to raise sufficient authority to show that a right is clearly established. And the Supreme Court has recognized that a right is clearly established not at a high level of generality, but one that's tailored to the facts of the case. So with respect to exigent circumstances, the gray area would be, even assuming that appellant has met her burden to show that the right is clearly established based on her reliance on Lucht, that...
Based on what?
On Lucht, the Eighth Circuit's holding in Lucht.
Is she also referring to the knock and announce statute?
Oh, certainly.
Okay.
But in order to tailor the right to the facts and to have a clearly established right, we cannot rely just on the general principle of reasonableness. There must be some sort of clearly established right that has been shown by some case law.
What is the clearly established right of a person who is confronted with two people in unmarked clothes, driving an unmarked car, not displaying a badge or a warrant, and their right to enter the house on the basis that they say, we are police? What, does she have a right there that's clearly established?
Again, it is appellant's burden to demonstrate what that right is. Now, appellant has relied
I think he's saying that I have a right to refuse entry into my home by officers or by people who don't display any authority to me to give me a reason why they can come in.
In this case, it's undisputed that Deputy Rourke first knocked on the door or rang the doorbell,
and then
he announced that he was a police officer, and on the way in, he said, I am here for Mr. Cobble.
And he shoved the door in, forced his way in then.
Correct.
And so she didn't invite them in.
Correct.
So what clearly established right are you saying she hasn't established?
I would put it another way. What clearly established right,
to what degree is to be free from unreasonable search and seizures in your home. That's not disputed.
Is that where exigent circumstances come into play?
Yes, exigent circumstances would arise with respect to excusing the one element of not being announced, which was stating before the entry that he had a warrant.
Okay, so you get in there, then is there a material issue of fact as to whether or not there was excessive force used in the search or entry into the property in executing the warrant?
Well, the Eighth Circuit's holding a lot.
Before you go there, I'm sorry, what is the, you're back on exigent circumstances, which Mr. Powers, I think he's claiming this is the strongest part of his argument. What is unclear or clear about exigent circumstances?
What's the hurdle there that you apparently argue you get over so that there is immunity here?
Sure. So appellant has relied on the Eighth Circuit's holding in Lund for the proposition that no reasonable officer in Deputy Rourke's position could have reasonably but mistakenly developed a reasonable suspicion of exigent circumstances. Lund provides a two-prong approach to the development of exigent circumstances. First, an officer must have some information that a suspect that is subject of the warrant is dangerous. And second, exigent circumstances must rest upon facts that arise during the service of the warrant.
Counsel, we talked about Lund in our earlier opinion, didn't we?
Yes.
And what did we conclude with respect to that?
Yeah, there was a material issue
of fact whether exigent circumstances existed in attempting to arrest Koppel.
Absolutely. In this case, the lens is different, as the district court noted, because we're looking to determine whether every reasonable officer in Deputy Rourke's position would have known that he was violating Lund. And that is the difference between, as the initial question was, between a bright line and a gray area. In this case, there's a two-pronged approach, as I just said. It's undisputed in the record that Deputy Rourke was aware of Mr. Koppel's law enforcement contacts, which included at least one weapons offense.
We don't know what that was.
It's not clear from the record.
We don't know.
In addition, is undisputed, and that would speak to the first prong of the Lucht holding. With respect to the second prong of the Lucht holding, it's undisputed that Deputy Rourke visually identified Mr. Koppel as he approached. It's also undisputed that appellant, through the window, was able to see the deputies approach the house. Therefore, a reasonable officer in Deputy Rourke's position could conclude that the deputies had been seen as they approached. Given these facts, I don't believe that Deputy Rourke can be said to have violated the bright lines of Lucht, because there are facts in the record pointing to both prongs of Lucht. And therefore, this at most could be a bad guess in a gray area. And that is precisely what qualified immunity is intended to protect officers from liability from.
What's the bad guess in the gray area we're talking about?
The bad guess, at most, would be that Deputy Rourke misweighed those facts and determined that they were exigent circumstances. There would be a different case if Deputy Rourke did not have any facts to point to satisfying those prongs of Lucht.
What would be the scope of the immunity in your view if he had a bad guess in a gray area? In other words, what actions, if in your view there is a bad guess, does that mean that the officer is therefore permitted to do what he did to Ms. Waldron, or run downstairs and try and catch the kid? What does that immunity actions following the bad guess apply to?
The question is not so much whether there was a constitutional violation, and that was where there was still a question of material fact. The question here is whether Deputy Rourke is entitled to the immunity.
For what?
For, first, for not going to announce the exigent circumstances, second, with respect to excessive force, and third, with respect to appellant's attack on probable cause.
Because where I'm going with this is, if you get qualified immunity, is it free for all? All the facts thereafter are encompassed by it all, or is there at some point a limitation on the scope of the immunity that you claim is evident?
I believe that the answer to that is qualified immunity should be applied to each of those alleged violations. That it would not necessarily be a domino effect.
You have to analyze each of the points of contention separately as to qualified immunity. Is that
absolutely
right?
So is there a claim? How does the excessive force factor into your qualified immunity?
So with respect to excessive force, the appellant has not satisfied her burden to show that she had clearly established right to be free from the exact type of handcuffing that was applied by Deputy Rourke in this case. The Eighth Circuit in Blazek confronted a handcuffing technique that is very similar to the one in this case. They granted qualified immunity to two officers. In the Blaze case, two officers were conducting a home check of a parolee when they encountered the parolee's roommate, who was clad only in a towel. They cleared the entire residence, then they attempted to question the roommate, who refused to answer questions about his identity, refused to stay seated as directed, and generally acted belligerently. There were two officers there and one roommate. One officer handcuffed the roommate during the course of a Terry stop by grabbing his arm, twisting it behind his back and up to his shoulder, and forcefully throwing him to the ground. The other officer jumped on top of him, and then both officers held him down to complete the handcuffing.
So if in your view there's immunity, then the officer can do what?
It's not so much that the officer may do that, because there still may be a constitutional violation, but the officer cannot be held liable because he is immune from liability for those actions.
How does the plaintiff's age and, I guess, physical ability to resist, how does that play into the analysis of qualified immunity in this case? And as it compares to the case you were just talking about, the big guy in the towel?
Well, I don't know that he was a big guy, but he was a half-naked guy, and it's not really clear that he was any more than passively resistant in the case, as the court found. So in this case, there was some actual resistance, and under the totality of the circumstances, which is what's required under Graham versus Connor, certainly age and frailty could be taken into consideration.
I guess I'm still back on my question that if things escalate, it's okay?
No,
it's always
not.
Okay?
That would end up going to, if it would fall outside, say, the scope of the inquiry of whatever the clearly established law is, if they had gone beyond that, but I don't think that in this case the handcuffing technique falls outside of what was just described.
But there's other acts. I think there's other undisputed acts besides handcuffing.
As far as excessive force?
Yeah, I'm not sure I have the details at hand, or did she fall? Was she thrown down? Was she...
Oh, absolutely. There were two hands.
There was a tussle.
Yes, it's very similar to what happened in Blazek, except that there were two handcuffings. During the first handcuffing, according to the appellant, Deputy Rourke started by handcuffing her left arm. Appellant held her right arm out into the side in order to resist. In order to overcome the resistance, Deputy Rourke pulled on her right arm, placed his knee on her back. During the course of the handcuffing, the appellant fell forward into the ground. She then slipped out of the handcuffs, and Deputy Rourke attempted to handcuff her again, this time starting with the right arm. She resisted with the left arm by holding it out to the side again. Deputy Rourke pulled on her arm without using his knee this time. And according to appellant, she fell backwards onto a couch and then slipped from the couch to the ground.
Does the court, in making the finding of qualified immunity, have to make a determination that the force used in subduing Mrs. Waldron was reasonable?
Absolutely not. It just has to find that Deputy Rourke did not violate clearly established law by this handcuffing technique. It does not necessarily find that this is constitutionally permitted. It's just that it was not so egregious as to fall outside the holding of a case like Blazer.
Does the court have to find that the force used was not excessive?
Doesn't have to find that it was not excessive, it just has to find that it did not violate clearly established law, so that it was not so excessive as to violate clearly established law like that in Blazek, where the Eighth Circuit in 2009 looked at a handcuffing technique that is very similar to what we just talked about, determined that the scope of the law at that time did not prohibit such a technique by clearly established terms.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Is there any time for rebuttal? The court now will take a 10-minute recess. So it is actually 10:42. So the court will be back at 10:50. 8-minute recess.